Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Rocket Mortgage, confidence. Support for the Adam Carolla Show comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Why can't clients get approved in minutes, not weeks? Or make adjustments to their rate and term in real time? Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans answered those questions and more. It gives you the confidence to buy a home or refinance your existing loan. Fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. That's right. That's what Rocket Mortgage does. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. What else do you need to know? And again, these guys support the show and are great sponsors. So, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. To get started, just go to rocketmortgage.com/Adam. That's rocketmortgage.com/Adam.
Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, the author of Three Dog Nightmare, Three Dog Nights, Chuck Negron. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, and another round of March Gradness. And now, Mama told him not to come. Actually, Mama never told him anything. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice for the on mandate. Get it on. And thanks for tuning in, and thanks for spreading the word. We love that about you, and thanks for making it possible by checking out sponsors like Marsha Clark's got a new show. Marsha Clark Investigates, the First 48. It's a series that premieres this Thursday, March 29th on A&E. I'll tell you more about that. Beachbody, text the word Adam to 303030. Set up your free trial. Check that out as well. Good day, Gina Grad.
Good day to you.
And Bald Brian. Nobody likes preaching more than me. Chuck Negron here from Three Dog Night. The book, Three Dog Nightmare, the Chuck Negron story. I love Three Dog Night. I guess everyone loves Three Dog Night. Good to see you, Chuck.
Oh, man. Nice to be here.
I've heard stories, legendary stories about Chuck. Maybe it was from sitting too close to Dr. Drew. I remember hearing stories about selling a building he owned just to get drugs.
Oh,
and
yeah, I did.
Stuff like that. And I just remember thinking, man, who was deeper into drugs than Chuck Negron? I mean, we've heard a lot of stories. We've heard about like snorting ants with Ozzy Osbourne and stuff like that.
Oh my God! The poor guy, he didn't know he couldn't get high. He thought he could get high on everything because basically he's high. I mean, he doesn't need anything.
So, Chuck, first...
Ozzy Osbourne?
Yeah.
Three Dog Night, 90 million albums sold. 90 million albums sold, 18 consecutive top 20 hits, and 6 number one songs, and 12 gold albums. I mean, it couldn't have gotten any bigger than Three Dog Night. I will say, I've always said... I love some of the deeper cuts, like Eli's Coming and songs like that, but I've always said that Black and White is one of my favorite songs, and it bothered me that Ebony and Ivory got a lot of spins when this was the ultimate black folk, white folk song. Ebony and Ivory stunk.
Pretty bad.
And let's listen to this for a second.
The ink is black, the page is white, together we child is black, child is
it's ironic that the Paul McCartney, Michael Jackson song is so soulless and so empty. Like, well, the two greatest musicians get together and write a song about, I think it's Michael Jackson.
Well, you know, two white guys, you know.
Brian, yeah. You got that look.
You did say with Michael.
Oh, maybe.
I think you're right, Brian.
It was Stevie Wonder?
I think it was Stevie Wonder.
These songs?
That's what I remember.
No,
I don't remember. No, I don't think so.
I think it's Michael Jackson.
It's Michael Jackson. It's Michael
Let's
Jackson.
See.
Yeah.
Ebony
It's Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder.
Oh, Stevie Wonder. Yeah. Oh, even worse.
It's way worse.
He did say around the same time.
Ah, that's what got me. He started work with all our blacks.
And the girl is mine. Don't forget.
Yes.
Oh, God, can we please go back to black and white?
The girl is one of Paul's.
That was a civil rights...
that song.
For the they didn't have any music. This was a civil rights... And what's this? Alan Arkin's father wrote it.
Really?
Yeah. He was part of the civil rights bill.
He wrote Black and White?
Not the music, just the lyrics, which were part of the march. They'd sing, "Well, a child is black, a child is white."
Right.
And we got a hold of it and got some music to it and became a number one record. We just thought it really basically was a really good cut. We had no idea it was going to do as well as it did.
How long was Three Dog Night around before Three Dog Night had success?
We 1967, we got together. Brian Wilson produced us. He wanted to sign us to Brother Records. And we went in and recorded a couple of songs with the L.A. Philharmonic. Brian was just over the top with really great production. And then the brothers came in and said, "We need these songs, and you need to work with us." So it was like so intense with the families. We just wanted to get out of there.
Brothers like Wilson?
Basically, it was Mike Love, who was kind of really against the whole thing. But the brothers...
You know how you can tell he's in the Beach Boys? He wears a goddamn Beach Boys hat everywhere he goes, which drives me insane.
Yeah,
I don't know why I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, he does.
Dave Chappelle doesn't bother me as much, him wearing jackets that say Chappelle on them. I don't know why, but Mike Love.
Why would Mike Love cover up that gorgeous head of hair with a hat all the time?
I've asked him that.
That's so weird.
So
yeah, he's a character.
So you guys around in 67, it's Beach Boys at the beginning and Love and everything else, but then when...
So we go from Brian to Van Dyke Parks. You know who Van Dyke Parks wrote with Brian? He wrote
Smile and all that
Smiley
stuff.
Smile and Heroes and Villains. And anyway, so we went with him. It didn't work. And then we ended up with Gabriel Meckler, and this is all in 1 year. And he did Born to Be Wild. He produced Born to Be Wild, one of the classic rock songs, Steppenwolf.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we went in the studio in 68 with a hit. The same year in 69 with our first number one record. So from 67 to 70, almost 77, we didn't stop. Put about 12 albums, and it was amazing.
Magic Carpet Ride and Born to Be Wild are the same.
Same guys. Same
Right. So... Steppenwolf, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then Three Dog Night. And so the thing that's always weird is I've always had the Magic Carpet Ride always sounded Three Dog Nighty to me.
Wow. Same producer.
Yeah, it always had a...
Yeah.
If you think about Three Dog Night back
Very
in the day and
that
Steppenwolf...
That you heard that,
I have a weird... I'm not good at
same
anything,
studio,
but I hear...
Same organ.
It always sounded like a Three Dog Night song
exactly
to me.
Exactly, same organ, same studio, same engineers.
Damn.
There it is, Brian Spass. Yeah, so now I know why... reminded me. It's like a weird... It's like a chef cooking the same meal, but they're different meals, but you had his flavor on it. And you guys went out with Steppenwolf,
They were a big act. We opened for them, and they were the first act that we were ever on the road with, the big act. And the first trip, we were getting on the plane, and they stopped John Kay at the door of the plane and said, "Open that case."
Lead singer from Steppenwolf.
Yeah, John Kay.
He used to call it John Kay and Steppenwolf then.
Yeah, that's when I guess the name thing was up for. And he opened this thing, had all these... chains and handcuffs and
strap-ons.
Yeah. And they always told me, said, "If you got a room next to John, move."
Things will come through the walls.
And I don't know why they knew it was in there, but anyway, so we went, "Oh, these guys are nuts." Little did I know, I was going to, be nuts myself.
Well, you were like an all-city basketball player in high school, and so you're athletic.
Yes.
To be an all-city, what city?
New York.
New York. All right. Yeah. So to be an all-city basketball player means, and in a city like New York, it means you're very accomplished athletically.
Yes.
So obviously, drugs, alcohol, not a big part of your life.
None. Zero.
Zero. Zero. So when did it come in?
As soon as I eventually got a record deal with Columbia as a solo act. And they just said, hey, you got to change your whole look. I look like a choir boy. And they started sending me to openings, premieres, and I looked different than everyone. You know, I ironed my socks, I swear to God. Mm-hmm. I was just that kind of a guy. So, you know, little by little, you know, I saw the people that were happening did not look like me. Mm-hmm. And then I ran into Danny Hutton, one of the guys from Three Dog Night at the party, who had a hit at the time, Roses and Rainbows. And a girl came over to me and kissed me and dropped something in my mouth. And he said, did you just drop? I said, yeah. She said, you went, that's cool, man. It's so cool. And I went, what do you think it is? You know, I had no idea. It was acid. It was acid. So I started right out of the gate. And the thing was, I really liked it.
Acid.
Yeah, I liked it.
Which, what was your weapon of choice?
Eventually, whatever you had. Basically, I ended up with heroin. I like cocaine, but I ended up with heroin, and I just wasn't a guy that would ever get there, and I did. I don't know how I did. I mean, I didn't have a drink of smoke until I was in my 20s.
Yeah, I think the thing that's pretty insidious about drugs, and now, especially with this whole opioid thing, which Dr. Drew's on the warpath about us sitting next to him yesterday. But so normally, you know, the thing that's insidious about drugs is you can make it out of high school, out of college, be fully formed, be voting and have all your thoughts together and then become a junkie.
Exactly.
But the thing that's crazy about the opioid thing is you can do this when you're 50.
Exactly.
Which usually if you can make it to 30, nobody starts smoking in their 30s. Yeah. Nobody starts.
I did at 25.
Nobody really starts with the cocaine or all the stuff we're talking about. If you make it through your 20s, it's like you're crime. Good. It's like crime. Who? Violent crime. Who's involved with all the violent crime? Men 15 to, you know, it's like men 16 to 25 or 27. Well, if you can make it through that corridor without putting your hands on another citizen, you're not going to start mugging people in your 30s.
I would say that's true.
The thing about the whole opioid thing is you have guys that formerly didn't even drink or do anything else, and they screwed their back up, and then they got prescribed this. And 47-year-old guys becoming junkies in middle age, in middle America, with no history of this. That's insidious.
I talked to a carpenter 2 days ago who read an article that was on Fox. Fox did this article I did. Anyway, he read it, and he sent me an email, and he left his phone number. So I called him. 45-year-old carpenter who'd never done drugs or drank in his whole life, but because of the work he did, his knees were shot, and he was strung out and been strung out for years now because he was trying to find a way to get clean. This guy is not your junkie. He's a guy that got caught up in drugs that probably should be monitored much better. And you know, when heroin was legal and heroin was, you know, you could buy it over the counter, they stopped it because it was too dangerous. You know, I don't understand. Well, I do understand money, but they don't just give another drug. Get that drug off the market.
Well, I have a couple things, and we'll get back into Three Dog Night.
Okay.
I used to say to Drew in 1997, 98, early, he'd tell me about guys that had 100 pill a day Vicodin habits, and I would say to him, well, this has to be a windfall for the drug companies, the manufacturers, the pharmaceutical companies. And he'd go, oh, no, please. No, come on. And I'd say, well, wait a minute. They're in the business of selling drugs. Vicodin, it's something, if taken as prescribed, you have to get your wisdom teeth pulled or have back surgery or something.
Four total.
Yeah, and then you take 4 or 5, and then you're done with it. You get your wisdom teeth pulled once, you have oral surgery or whatever, you take out 5 or 6 or whatever for the next few days, and then you're done for the rest of your life or for the next several years. That's not moving product. You get a whole bunch of guys doing 100 tablets a day. That's moving product. And he, Drew, always poo-pooed it. He was like, you're too cynical. No, the drug companies are not happy about this. And I said, why wouldn't they be happy about it? And I was just like an atheist, and he kept telling me I was naive and I didn't know what I was talking
about. Like the cigarette companies.
Yeah, he doesn't say that now, by the way.
You can be not happy but also recognize that something's profitable. Like, oh boy, more addicts. Like, you're probably not saying that, but you're like, this clearly increases our bottom line. This is a
benefit for the company. If you sell toilet paper, you should hope that TPing houses comes back in vogue.
Yes.
They're taking your product and throwing it into the air instead of two wipes at a time.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
I'm sure there were New York, you know, construction, many of them who benefited from 9/11, rebuilding the whatever, but I'm sure they were happy about it. Like, they're not.
So you're pro-terrorist?
Was that not obvious?
Oh, Brian.
Jesus Christ.
Wow, you really walked into it. Yeah.
I went right up to the line and danced on it. You sped across it.
You need to think about what you said.
No, he does say that now. He does go, I blame the drug companies. Of course they were profiting off this. And my thing was just a simple math. How could they not be profiting?
Well, what's happening? One of the things that's happening is that these opioids are hitting a part of the brain that stimulates almost immediately a craving, a desire for it that usually happens after months or years of using certain drugs.
Right. Oh, well, that's the other thing. It's like instantaneously.
And these people, you know, they believe that they need it even when they're buying it on the street. Like, you know, I said, didn't you run out of your prescription to this guy? And he said, well, yeah, I can get him on the streets. I said, wasn't that a sign that something was wrong? You're going into neighborhoods, you're a carpenter. And but I needed them. You know, just
well, the other, the study just came out, too, that just basically said long-term pain relief, this is not an effective way to go.
Not at all.
Like, it's great for the oral surgery in the next 3 days. And Drew said even 2 weeks. But after that, not effective. So the fact that you have this pain and it's 6 months after the accident or whatever it is, and you need more to get right.
Yeah.
It doesn't even work. It's not even effective.
It's very sad. It is sad. I fell and broke two ribs in my house, and I had to go to the emergency room. And right next to me, I could hear the guy, and he was an old man. He was an old guy. And he's going, look, I know I shouldn't have done all my pills, and he was there to get more pills because of his hip surgery, and they said they couldn't give him any more. And basically, all the talk he was saying, he was an addict. I mean, I could hear it. I mean, I knew
you can hear an addict.
I can hear it. And I said, but he didn't know. And here's an old man that was just given a drug that he shouldn't have been given. It's very, very sad.
All right, so back to you and Three Dog Night. So Three Dog Night just becomes a
juggernaut.
Hit factory. I mean, just could do no wrong. You're ironing your socks, but you're getting your look together, and you're getting exposed in this world. Obviously, high school basketball, not laden with drugs, but now the music world in the 60s, early 70s, it's nonstop and nothing but.
Yeah.
And also, there is no stigma. So now, if you're at a party in Hollywood and you'd like to do some cocaine, you must go to the bathroom and shut the door. In the 60s and 70s, if you weren't doing cocaine, it was stigmatized, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, at the Grammys, the first Grammy I'd ever been to, went into the bathroom. And,
what year?
This was 70. 1970. First Grammys, we were invited to do a number that wasn't even nominated. It couldn't be nominated. It came out too late. But it was so huge, they had to sing the song. The next year, it was nominated. It was a whole year it was a hit. And Joy to the World.
Right.
And we did it again. But when I went into the bathroom to do a little cocaine, two heads of two major companies said, no, try this.
Really?
Executives. So everyone, it was out in the open. And you know, I mean, I thought, I can't believe this. And it's the way it was. I was actually pretty naive, but I caught up. You know,
did you have alcoholism in your family? Because something it took with you big time, right?
My uncle. I had an uncle that I didn't even know was an alcoholic until I became a drug addict. And I went, oh, my uncle did. My uncle. And I asked my mother, he said, oh, yeah, he was a raving drunk.
Yes.
So you had my uncle, mother's brother.
You had the genetic component.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
For it. And what did it then, I'll tease it, but when did it start
coming undone? Because there's obviously there's a time when you can live with this. You can live with your bandmates. They can live with you. Everyone can be high. You can make money. You can sell records and all that. But then at a certain point, it'll catch up to you. And I want to know how long you're able to do it, who else in the band was into it, and how long before it caught up. And when it did catch up, what was the representation of it catching up to you? I'll tell you about Marcia Clark Investigates, the First 48. New original docuseries premieres Thursday, March 29th, 9 p.m., only on A&E. Marcia Clark delves into some of America's most shocking unsolved crimes and controversial verdicts. Each two-hour episode explores a different investigation, taking an in-depth look at the First 48 after the crime to uncover new revelations and angles. Controversial murder cases include Casey Anthony's daughter, Kaylee, and Chandra Levy. God, so much misinformation about everything all the time.
Speaking of benefiting from 9/11.
Yeah, Robert Blake's wife, Bonnie Lee Bakley, remember her? Run DMC's Jam Master Jay and Drew Peterson's wife, Stacey. You're going to be all over this, Gina.
So I can't wait.
Lynette's going to be all over.
I love Marcia Clark. I cannot wait for this.
That is Thursday, March 29th at 9 p.m. on A&E. So, Chuck, by the way, the book, Three Dog Nightmare, the Chuck Negron story, final edition, available now on Amazon, originally published in 1999, but 11 new chapters and 100 new photos. So check it out and bookmark us and click through us and help the whole thing get along here. So you're into drugs. What's the rest of the band into?
Okay, so this is how it goes. I played college ball as well, so I'm in really good shape to get high.
Right.
I'm going to last a while.
Right.
Anyway, but some of the guys started falling. We had our bass player, who we had to let go of in 70, cocaine, and he got one of our people really hurt, because he beat the wrong people in New York for cocaine. They almost killed our road manager, who he set him on. He's got the money. And the guy, my road manager, laughed at him. But anyway, so we had to let him go. Then the second guy was Danny Hutton. He got to the point he was jaundiced. He had a nurse. He should not have been on. He literally had a real nurse that gave him B12 shots to watch him so he wouldn't die. And
while he's touring?
Touring, yeah. Oh, this guy was yellow. His eyes, everything.
What was his weapon of choice? Was it cocaine?
Cocaine, but he could drink. I think the drink was really what was killing him. Oh. And a lot of pills. He liked his pills. I mean, you walk by his room, there are three layers of trays with shot glasses, 50 shot glasses all together. And, you know, he really could put it away. So we finally had to, you know, let him go. During that period, the keyboard player gets hooked on heroin. Now, he was my best man at my wedding, so we hung out together, and you know we both did it. Corey was straight as an arrow, a world class fly fisherman.
Wow!
Yeah, yeah. We'd be coming back, and he'd be on a bass boat behind a limousine, ready to go fishing at 5 in the morning. Swear to God!
Right.
And so
you'd be coming home.
Yeah, we'd be coming home. He's
ready to go out.
Yeah, he'd just shake his head, you know.
In the movie, he's the first one to die.
Right.
So, you know, so anyway, he was straight. And the rest of the guys did cocaine, but they kind of let it go when it was time. I gave them their first number one record, their first million selling, and I gave them their last, which was in 75. And in 76, I gave them their last top 40 song. So I was there from the beginning to the end. And the only three that were left of the seven was Corey Wells, Jimmy Greenspan, and myself. When we decided after the Greek Theater, we're never going to do it again. Now, that's when the problem happened for me. I was very wealthy. I had nothing to do. And I didn't think you could go through that kind of money. And
how much money are we talking about?
Well, you know, it's, I don't know, $3 or $4 million. But then I had a pension plan, and I had apartment buildings, and I had this one that you were speaking of earlier in Beverly Hills. That had, you know, had suites with elevators. I mean, we did every, you know, this place was unbelievable. And little by little, I just let let it all go. Let me tell you, I knew I was in trouble when I was taking care of my kids at my ex-wife's house because she was on the road with Greg Allman. And then she comes home with Greg Allman. Mm-hmm. And I'm there watching the kids sleeping on the couch. And they're in, you know, my ex-wife. So Greg walks in the living room and he looks at me and goes, "Man, you're really bad. Greg Allman's telling me.
Wow.
I'm really bad."
Did you know him before this?
Oh, yeah.
Incident?
Yeah, okay. I knew Greg. They opened up for us. The Allman Brothers opened up for
us. It's a yes or no question.
Yes. great band. And I knew I was in trouble when Greg
Allman. Yeah.
When he said
so I was so upset that I waited until I went to sleep. And I went in the room. I stole his watch and all his money. And the next day he said, "Where's my stuff?" And, you know, I said, I don't know, you know. Anyway, we almost got into it, but we didn't because I was so sick. Anyway, years later, when I got clean, I bought him the greatest watch, and on the back I said, "For the one I stole from you."
Oh yeah. My God,
that's awesome!
And he wore it all the time.
That's great.
Now, as far as you know, now and Three Dog Night and you know, publishing and all that, is it are you set, are you taken care of?
You know what, yeah, I'm good. I'm not a rich man, but you know, I'm good. I have my royalties. We've got some publishing, and I do own seven of the masters.
So I feel like Three Dog Night, I don't feel like Three Dog Night sort of ever went away. There's some groups that sort of go away, and then Quentin Tarantino puts their song in a movie, and then they kind of come back again or something.
Yeah.
But Three Dog Night has just always been sort of ubiquitous, and in movies and things like that.
Oh, it's wonderful.
But just everywhere.
Just that alone makes my life very comfortable.
That's got to be the greatest thing ever. You write a song when you're 23 years old, and 50 years later, someone wants to pay you a wad of cash to put it in their movie. And by the way, all that's going to do is expose more people to your music
to the
from
music,
50 years ago, and you'll sell a few more.
Well, they're still out there. The guys, there's two left, and they're still out there as Three Dog Night. Mama, this guy was great. Corey.
Boogie Nights.
God, was he good.
Now, this is... Wasn't a song written by Randy Newman?
This song was written by Randy Newman. It wasn't a hit. It was not even close to a hit. It was a really bizarre, without this feel. It was, you know, it was just kind of Randy's story. And when he heard we were doing it, we actually got the message from him and said, "How are you doing? It's not a hit, guys."
Right.
You know, and we just revamped
it. Showed him.
It's what we did. But we ran into Randy, Amy and I, a couple of years back in the airport. And I went, "Hey, Randy." Oh, and his wife immediately, "Thank you. You put my kids through college."
With that song.
She said, "Yeah, they were so gracious." And said that, and I said, "Oh, you had a lot of time." No, that song has really been good to us, you know?
Right. Wow. And then a short guy punched him in the balls.
Walking. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So is Three Dog Night, there is a version of Three Dog Night that's out there?
Two original members are left. Danny Hutton, who sang Black and White. And that's really the only hit he had. Oh, no, he had Liar, which was a...
Oh, Liar. We've got to find Liar.
Yeah, that's a very great song.
I like that song a lot. Yeah. I don't hear this song... This song doesn't get as many spins as it should.
It's because it's so different.
Right.
You know, and that's, I think, what's great about it.
Yeah, well, Three Dog Night was like, in a weird way, this is meant as a compliment, but they're like the Rascals or the Hollies.
Yeah.
In that they had so many different types of songs. People don't realize that the Hollies had this song and that song.
Right,
In a weird way, you don't even know that there's all Hollies songs or all Young Rascal songs or Rascals or all Three Dog Night songs.
Yeah, a lot of different stuff. Actually, the Hollies, I mean, he and Harry, he's my brother. That's like out of left field for them. It was just really just great, different song.
Well, because they... Oh, here come they! Oh, I was going to yell "Liar" at you. because they did "Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress" or whatever,
I know.
It all sounded completely different than "He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brothers." It sounded good.
Yeah,
totally
good group.
I agree.
Yeah, I like them. I liked them when Graham was with them, and then when Nash went, and then when he left, it, you know, they I think that's part of the reason they did the change. They lost that intense high voice.
Three Dog Night must have toured with everybody everywhere, right?
Yeah, but not as only the touring, but yeah, the festival.
Who opened for you guys?
Everybody. The festivals were amazing. Let's see who.
Well, but you had to catch some. Yeah, the thing that's cool is you had to catch people on the way up.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So you had to have Aerosmith open for you.
They
or
did.
Some, right.
Aerosmith did. ELO.
Right.
Ike and Tina Turner. God, everybody. God, I can't think of anyone right now.
Were you about to say Rod Stewart?
Yeah, Rod Stewart. He was funny. We sold out the Cotton Bowl.
And wow.
We put him on the show to sell the last thing. So actually, Rod Stewart in the Faces. And he comes walking in our dressing room with his clothes, and he goes, yes, this is much better. and the roadman goes, I'm sorry, you ruined something. He goes, it's unacceptable. And he says, I'm going to do, this is good.
In your dressing room.
In our dressing room. So he said, you know, finally, he said, you don't understand, this is the guy's. He was a star before he was a star.
I mean,
he just
some
had
guys
that,
have that swagger.
Makes sense.
That attitude, you know.
Did you see it with your Aerosmiths or your whomevers? Did you know it like, oh, these guys are going to keep going?
Yeah, you know, for the most part, you did. You did. Like one band I didn't think was going to make.
Journey.
Journey.
I'm trying to think of Aerosmith.
You know,
bands.
Steve Perry, it's such a shame this guy isn't singing. That's one of the great true tenors of all time.
Is he unable to sing,
no,
or is he choosing not to sing?
He just kind of wanted away from all the drama, and he did have hip problems. He had to have hip replacements. So.
It saddens me that so many bands have these riffs and they can never recover, and they leave so much money and so much entertainment and so many good memories like on the table just because they can't be in the same room together anymore, which is a weird and powerful thing that maybe in a weird way, maybe artists are the douchiest people in the world because when two brothers who are loggers get into an argument, at some point they make up and then they're able to do it again. Yeah, and when blue collar guys get in an argument, they get into a fist fight and then they have some beers or whatever it is.
Yeah. Hug it
artists
out.
May be the douchiest of all time because they keep this shit going and they'll never be in the same room again.
What could have been?
Yes.
What could still be?
The Gallaghers. You need an artist gene to think that way or an ego or something.
In the early 2000s, I had a partner, and we came up with a lot of money, and the plan was, because CAA had called us and said, this is what you got to do, we want to put a tour together.
Right.
Want to put a tour together, but just got to get off the road for a year, want you to woodshed, da-da-da. The guys were making at that time take home $300,000 each. That's what they took home.
Three Dog.
Yeah, the guys on Three Dog Night, and they were all but me and Floyd. And Joe, the guy who had passed away, we offered them $400,000 to get off the road free,
right,
for a year. They turned it down.
Oh my God!
They turned it down because of it reinforces what you just said. They just didn't, you know, there's too much drama. You know?
It's so, especially as you get older and people mellow, and it's like, why can't Eddie Van Halen be in the same room with David Lee Roth or Sammy Hagar? Or like, why is like everyone's in their 50s or 60s and beyond? What we're looking for is a payday, and then we'll go home to a nice hotel room, and Rod Stewart will kick you out of your suite and put you into steerage. But it's weird that it can't be done for so many people, and also it's weird, something that I've thought about a lot is how many adults fly in the face of logic. Like, here's your opportunity, here's your payday, here's your future, and they just go F yourself, I'm going over here. Like, there's a lot of that, adults, and I didn't, as a kid, I didn't envision adults acting that way. Yes, Brian.
I was saying, with the artist stuff, sometimes it never dies. We all saw the Eagles documentary, the great Eagles documentary. Right. And there's a great, amazing moment at the end where these guys are in their 60s. They're getting together for a multi-million dollar reunion tour. And I think it was Don Felder couldn't keep it together. He's like, I want the same money as Don Henley and Glenn Frey. They're like, get out. Like, we didn't like you to begin with, and now you got to go.
Right.
But like, it never dies. This should be a gravy train to heaven, and they couldn't
let
it go.
That's a common story, actually. A lot of guys.
That's what I'm saying. I'm sure
they want the same money and they just leave.
The idea was you guys stay off the road for a year so we can have some demand come up. And also, we don't want this version of the band.
Yeah, we want to advertise it slowly for a year. We want you in the woodshedding, recording everything. And by the way, a couple of years later, they did that same thing with Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, my God.
Oh, right.
And that was that tour.
And
the same people.
And they came back, made $1 billion.
The same people.
Yeah.
The same people. And it's like mind-boggling that it didn't happen. Because then I was willing to do it. It finally got to the point where we were offered $9 million, $3 million each, to do a reunion tour. This was later by another big touring company. And I went to see them. We all sat down. Well, we didn't sit down. They didn't talk to each other, so they were in different rooms.
Who are the two?
Danny and Corey did hate each other. Matter of fact, if a hotel had one elevator, one of them stayed on the first floor.
Wow.
Yeah, because they fought. So I spoke to them, and one of them was just...
But how old are they at the time of this meeting?
They're 60.
Uh-huh. Wow. So it's been 35 years.
Yeah, 35, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, this was me. I couldn't do it. I spent the evening with Danny, and it was just, he was so drunk I couldn't even understand him. You know, and I was only sober, I don't know, 5 or 8 years. I'm now 26 years sober. But so for me, it was a precarious situation, and I decided for my health. My health and my life, I'm not doing it. So I walked away at that point because too many guys were too fucked up. Excuse my language.
Sure, and they just left $9 million on the table.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I know. There's no way you could get 2% of America to understand that scenario.
Oh, no, not at all. I don't understand it. You know, when you go, when you're a heroin addict for 20 years, and you've been through 37 rehabs for 13 years, and you weigh 126 pounds, and you have 15 teeth left, and all of a sudden you're in a place, and you wake up, and you don't no longer want to use drugs. It just a prayer and an answer, and just let me die, or please stop this obsession. And it ended. And I knew that I was never going to put myself in a situation that I would ever go back. And Three Dog Night was a bad situation. It wasn't worth millions of dollars for me to be around that. You
saw where that path was going to lead.
Right. Yeah, well, I didn't know. I knew it could have.
Yeah.
Plus, I didn't want to be around people who couldn't talk. It was, it was like, you know, 60-year-old man, he just said, I love you, man. Where you been?
Right.
You know, terrible.
I'd like to, I'm going to tease this one, which is, don't answer any of these questions.
That's how we interviews.
Three Dog Night.
Don't answer any of these questions.
I'll provide all the answers in post. I'll slug them in post. Sounded a little like Andrew Dice Clay when he did that first voice when he does his, I don't know, when he's doing his girl voice or something, but anyway.
I love him.
All right, so, Three Dog Night aside, you're an artist. You want to perform. You want to sing. You want to play. You know. Mm-hmm. So I want to know what satiates that for you, and I want to know what a day in the life of Chuck Negron is now, and also your cousin Taylor Negron. We forgot about Taylor Negron. Would be one of the, if you don't know the name, certainly very recognizable when you see the face as a character actor.
Heavy rug.
I will tell you. I will tell you about Beach Body on Demand, online fitness streaming service, unlimited access to a variety of effective world-class workouts personalized to your needs, plus nutritional content, convenient, accessible on your computer, web-enabled TV, tablet, smartphone. any other web-enabled device. No need to go to the gym. You can do it all from your home or when you're traveling in your hotel room or wherever you're at, because you got your phone with you and you can work it out that way. Annual subscription is cheaper than any gym membership. Programs for any level of fitness, cardio, weight training, yoga, low impact, dance, 600 different workouts. So what do you do? Well, right now, my listeners, and try it out for free. Get a free trial membership. Text the word ADAM to 303030. That's ADAM. Then 330s. Check that out. It's free. Why wouldn't you do it? Take 10 seconds to check it out. Full access to all the workouts, nutrition information, and it's free. Just text the word ADAM to 303030. Try it out for free. So, Chuck, what is a day in the life of Chuck Negron like? And also, what do you do to perform, or do you perform, or do you have that itch?
Yeah, I have been performing. I will do almost 60 shows this summer from June to September. I've done that for the last several years with a tour called the Happy Together Tour, and it's the Turtles and then various different artists.
That was their big song.
Yeah, it's a great tour, and we do sheds and amphitheaters. It's a nice venue. I mean, a nice gig. So I do that in the summer. I just got back from Florida. I just did a really great corporate show with Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, the lead singer from Def Leppard.
Oh, really?
Billy Ocean.
Yeah.
The lead singer from Everclear.
Sure, Art. Alex
Oakes. It was huge.
Yeah. Crew, yeah.
A lot of money was spent. And these guys were fantastic. So I do those things. And I'm working all the time. Just had an album out that I did with two of my daughters. It's my sixth solo album.
How much Three Dog Night material do you do? All Three Dog Night material? Is there rules that prevent you from doing some of it?
No, there are no rules. It's rock and roll. No, but yeah, actually in rock and roll there are a lot of rules now. But no, I can do anything I want. We've been to court already. we have.
It can't go any other way.
When I wrote the book, they wanted to stop it. They hadn't even read it. And if you ever read the book, you'll see I don't trash these guys. You know, I mean, I didn't do it. Now I just wrote a new edition, wrote 11 new chapters, and I trashed them.
The long game.
I waited.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of them died. I said, "Fuck,
it's on.
I'm not going to get this done."
Well, as I've stated before, you know, you talk a lot of shit. When I wrote a book. A few books, but one of the books I wrote, you know it when you get on the phone with the publisher and the attorney with the publisher, and they just have to fact check. So if you said in your book, if in Chuck Negron's book, he said, "One night we're on the road in Detroit, I met a young Linda Ronstadt and bedded her in my hotel, best sex I ever had." That's fine to put in the book, but they need to vet it.
Right.
Because if that never happened, then Linda Ronstadt's going to sue your ass. So you have these weird conversations where they go, "Did you actually nail Linda Ronstadt or not?" And I got the call from the lawyer and
about
from the
Linda
publisher. They just said, "Are your parents litigious?" I said, "I don't think they know what that means, but no." And they're like, "Okay, good, because you talked a lot of smack." I was like, wow. Asked if your parents were litigious.
Wow.
That's an asshole son.
I have a story. They call me and they want me to come in. And I come in and I'm sitting down. There's like 10 people there. And they're just looking at me. Everyone's very, very serious. And I go, "You know, Chuck, this is a very uplifting book. I think a lot of Christians would like this. But one thing they're not going to like." And he says, "Hold on." He picks up a list. He says, "Chuck, you have 17 fuck yous." Mm-hmm. "Six suck my dick." Excuse my language. Anyway, on and on and on. Says, "Were you willing to take that out?" And I said, "I can take it all out, but suck my dick."
You're a reasonable
good
man.
Answer, yeah.
You're willing to negotiate.
That's a great joke.
Negotiation.
Somebody played one of Chuck's songs at his wedding. Also, we have Andrew Dice Clay doing the girl voice.
Oh, God.
We'll listen to it, see if Chuck can do it.
He's doing
all
well.
All the years you were dating them, they follow you around. Are we going to get married? You think we'll ever get married? You think it would be good if we ever got married? And one day they catch you.
Now, hold on, Chuck. That was your first drunk voice, I think. Can you do that?
What, will ever get married? Lazia.
Oh,
darling.
Well,
that's him.
That's him.
No, in the neighborhood that I lived in, the drunks would go, darling, listen.
Let's talk to...
I love you, man. I love you, man. Yeah.
Shake, 27, Pensacola.
Where you been?
Jake?
What's going on?
Hey, man. Which one of Chuck's songs was at your wedding, played at your wedding?
Pieces of it.
Oh, Joy to the World.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You got to play that one.
Can't.
It's a fun song.
I'm over here. I'm headed to the meat swap.
You're heading to the what?
Oh, the meat swap, not the swap.
Oh, is that a meat swap? Oh, that's a gay bar.
Oh.
Right, swap meat, something different. Thanks, Jake.
Yeah,
it's a lucky lady to have you.
We love you, Jay. We love you, man.
I don't mean to play
the same song in their divorce proceedings.
Joy of the World. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to one up Jake, but you were on our morning show here in Los Angeles, 100.3. Yeah. You know, Mark Thompson's on, and the day that station went off the air, every DJ, everyone on air, got to come in and play the one song that meant most to them. And everybody's playing these really sad songs and these really sentimental songs. And I come in, and Uncle Joe Benson's kind of running the whole thing, and he said, "Gina, you have an interesting choice after everything we've been listening to." And I said, "Yeah, it's my favorite song. It's my favorite song in the whole world." Uh-huh. On a day like this that's so bitter and sweet in some ways, but really sad, I want to hear the song that only brings me joy, and I played Shambhala. It's my favorite song.
That's right.
Great song. I love this song. It is my favorite song, just in general.
It's great. The acoustic guitar is so great at the beginning.
Just this opening alone.
My Michael and our producer, actually. The fans love this every time we do it.
Who's singing?
This one's Corey. Corey and I did. I did like me wanted to more than him the hits, but it's him and I.
You did the harmonies on this, yes?
Oh yeah. I'm doing the harmonies, high parts.
Here it comes.
All that high stuff. Yeah. That's my sexy voice there. Yeah.
I love you.
Oh damn.
Here's where it gets really high.
Oh, it's coming.
Yeah, it's coming. Forgot about this one.
It's my favorite song.
Everyone is lucky. Everyone is so kind. On the road to Shambhala.
Love, love you, man.
I didn't know you could hear that.
The BGBs.
Buried deep.
How hard... Oh, wait, it's coming. We'll go up a few octaves. How hard was this to recreate live?
We were better live than any record we made.
Really?
That's what made Three Dog Night. When people heard us, they went, we were better than the records. Because we did the records, we were learning the songs.
Right.
Putting them together. So when we did it, when we got them together, we went on the road and we just tore it up. We were the real deal. Everyone sang. Everyone played. We had our own band that did every record with us. And it was a great, great live band. It was a great band. No one wanted us follows in those festivals. The only one that never said no was Jimi Hendrix. But a lot of acts just bailed. They said, no, you put them on after us.
Right. No, I get it. As a comedian, you don't want to go on in front of some guy that just destroys the
exactly.
place.
Yeah.
And, it's. I always think about it when bands have songs that are, tall orders. Like when you hear a Willie Nelson song, you go like, I guess he's not going to be trouble crapping that out because he's kind of talking into a microphone, holding a beer and smoking a joint. But sometimes you can get to this third eye blind situation where your hit is sort of undoable live. Yeah. And that's like your big hit. And I like Steven, but that song is not, that is a very tough song to pull off. Live.
And that's what the people want to hear.
And that's what people want to hear. Yeah, and then that becomes this weird mistress because it's like, this is what they came for, but if you can't pull it off, if you can.
Yeah, that we actually, when we made records, we were very careful not to overdub stuff that we could not do live. that was too important. I mean, we were very careful. Look, we're going to have to make that in the body of the song and take out the other part because we won't be able to play it live.
You know? Well, and your words ring true to me as I think about doing comedy, which is, yeah, that's right. When you're in the studio, you're not familiar with the song, or you're just familiar with the song. And then you go out and you hit the road hard, and you just get so many reps.
Yeah.
And by the time you're playing it for the 100th time, it is tight the way it couldn't be in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We were so tight that we had to be actually careful of not looking too slick. Because there were nights we went, hey, guys, this sounded like a record.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it was a great band. I love being, I really did love being a part of it. And, you know, they're, as I said, they're still going. We just lost two guys in the last 3-4 years.
Corey
passed away and Jimmy Greenspan passed away.
Was one of them the fly fisher?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sad that all you junkies outlived the clean living fly. There is no God, right?
No, it's not fair.
It's not fair.
And while I was alive, I looked much better than he did.
It's sad. Yeah, it's all genetics.
Cruel.
So cruel. And what is the message to my young kid?
What am I supposed to take away from
Put
this?
Down that rotten reel and pick up a syringe, boy.
Oh, you'll be just fine.
You'll be just fine, yes.
But speaking of your boy, Chuck brought his own stuffy today. And I don't know if you noticed that.
I did notice that. I chose not to comment on it. But it's too late now.
Too late.
It sings.
It's a singing stuff.
Mama good. Told me not to come.
Broken wiener.
It's a broken wiener.
Chuck's this is very the broken famous wiener. Story.
I heard about the broken wiener story.
Well, my significant other here just got tired of hearing about it, and this is her answer to
your wiener was broken because it was. It was overused.
Yeah.
He was in a Miss America contestant.
Miss Oklahoma.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which they hated putting in there. By the way, I had Chris Blatchford, who's I think like a 30-time Emmy winner for writing. He vetted everything. If we didn't have 2 to 3 people that verified every story I had, we didn't use it.
Right.
So it was great. Because
you'd be in a lawsuit.
Yeah. So we verified everything, and so it was good. What happened was I noticed that, what did I say, junk?
Yes.
Was getting big, you know, but it was very sore.
Mm-hmm.
But it was big, so I liked the bigness. I put up with the soreness because of the bigness.
Right.
Amen.
So anyway, I got to the point that it was very painful. And I went to the doctor, and they said, you have damaged some of your nerves. And the blood, he showed me how the blood comes in and the blood goes out. He said, the blood is not leaving.
Ooh.
And every time you get an erection, it's just going to get big. You know, it's not going to leave.
Right.
So you need to not have that happen because you're going to lose the ability to continue any romance.
So don't get a boner.
Don't get a boner. So he said, you know, you have a timeout. And so I stopped and... A couple of weeks later, I ran into this beautiful, my girlfriend's in there too, this is terrible. I ran into, that's why she did the weenie, that's her answer.
You ran into Miss Oklahoma.
Yeah, and as I...
And even though the doctor said,
it was 2 weeks and it was, you know, going back to its little self.
Right.
And... you know, so, you know, one thing led to another, and during the connection, I heard a split, I swear to God, just like Psycho.
Wow.
I swear to God.
I believe it.
And she went, what's that? And some other stuff happened that freaked her out, and I was just blood everywhere, and we rushed me to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
And all that blood was really, really scary. And when they stopped it and they were going to sew me up and everything, it was terrible. All of a sudden, all these doctors and nurses were coming in and they're going, giggling, and they're going, well, over here. And they're like pretending they're doing medical work.
Right.
And they're just goofy on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, over here, you can see we're going to do like 10 stitches here and we might have to stitch inside. And anyway, so I had a minor little... surgery, they you know, they sewed me back. They sewed me back up. And
how many stitches?
I think there was almost 20 because there was stitches inside and then stitches outside. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty good, you know, pretty good
seam rip.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I was sidelined for put on the bench, so to speak.
Sure.
And you know, when I got older, you know, I one day was, you know, things weren't right, and I had to go get an MRI of my peepee, mm-hmm. and they do have one for the peepee. Can
they have
that?
An MRI machine for that?
Yeah, have it. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's a smaller tube.
Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah. Anyway, so, and they said, well, you know, right here, the blood, the nerves aren't. And I said, that's exactly where. He said, I can see the scar. And, you know, little by little, it came back to its robust.
Mm-hmm. God bless.
Pumping. Former self.
Yeah.
Pulsating.
Yeah.
I love you, man.
He's gritting his teeth. All right, Chuck's got a heart out. We got one more question for him, and Brian in Portland's got it. Brian, Portland? Hey, I'm coming to Portland, the Aladdin Theater, June 9th, so come say hi.
Oh, that's a great place.
It is a great place. Thanks, Brian. And Chuck, go ahead and ask Chuck a question.
Hey, well, first of all, hello, Adam, Gina, and Balls.
Hey.
I just want to say hey there.
I love you, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Chuck says hi.
Chuck.
Yes.
You have such a great reputation for being a party guy, but, you know, you guys had gotten the song One from, I believe, Harry Nilsson. I wonder if you could just talk about that experience, and also did you get a chance to party with Harry at all? Because he was also known for being a little bit of a partier himself.
Yeah, well, Harry and I became very, very good friends. I'll start at the end and then move forward. When Harry had a party, invited all his closest friends and Harrison. A lot of
George Harrison.
George Harrison. Yes, a lot of people were there, and he told us all that he was going to die. That he needed to have heart surgery, but he was over 300 pounds, and he had to lose the weight. He had to lose the weight and get in shape, else they couldn't do it.
How old was he at the time?
50. I mean, he wasn't old. He wasn't old. And we said, well, just lose the weight. And he said, no, I'm not going to change my life. He's still doing everything that he was doing. He made a conscious decision that it was enough.
Jeez.
You know, but I met Harry. I had one was played for me by an A&R guy.
Let's hear a little of it there, yeah. Brian. Sorry, just for the younger folks that don't
know. Cool, yeah.
At any rate, I got the song. I changed it all around because Harry's is kind of maudlin. And the first time I met Harry was with George Harrison and Richard Perry, and he walked up to me at a restaurant. I was with a friend, and he just, right out of bat, he said, you know, I don't like your version. You know, it's not near as good as my version. And I said, you know what, Harry, but mine's going to make you some money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he immediately liked me because he's a confrontational guy. So anyway, he was a great guy. I thank him for the song, and he always thanked me for the arrangement that I did. And I liked Harry, but Harry, if he got drunk, you had to leave because he liked to fight.
Wow. Did he have the song Dawson about getting high in his cab, or is that another? Who was that? Who was the guy? Who was the guy who? There's two guys that get confused. I get Harry Nilsson, and then the guy who died in his Volkswagen Bug on the bridge going to play a gig. Who is the other singer? Song "Cats in the Cradle" guy, maybe, or something like that. There's two guys that get confused. I get Harry and this guy, but Harry was. Is the song about picking up his girlfriend, his ex-girlfriend?
Harry Chapin.
Oh, Chapin. Yeah, Nilsson and
Chapin.
Chapin
are the
two guys.
Brothers.
I get confused because Harry Chapin was the picked up his girlfriend driving his hack, and she's rich now, and she's an actress, and he's getting stoned in his cab.
Yeah, song which, called Taxi. So that's
Taxi.
Probably,
yeah, that's the song that play 10 seconds of Taxi. Just
it's
going to make
he's a good
7-minute song.
Well, so just play 3/4 of it.
Something about her was familiar.
There he is.
I could swear I seen her face before.
Could you ever do a 7-minute song like this?
That
got a lot of radio spins back in the day.
That's amazing that he did. Yeah. They never played.
It's like 7 minutes long, and it got a ton of spins.
I can't imagine.
I mean, they went nuts when Dylan came out with Rolling Stone. It was over 4 minutes long.
Incredible. All right. Yeah, so you make these guys, money. So that'd be the greatest windfall ever. Like, if I wrote a joke and it never really worked, and then someone just took it and said, let me put my own flavor on it, and then I just got checks in the mail, that'd be the greatest thing that ever happened in my life.
And then Amy Mann, of course, recorded that song for Magnolia, which a lot of people remember, too.
Actually, they were going to use us, and but we were too expensive. We get paid. So anyway, good luck for her. So it's good. It was
Amy
good for
Mann
her.
Did one.
Yeah, it was really
the opening, I believe, of Magnolia.
Oh yeah,
she's a sweetheart.
The
by the way,
de facto soundtrack. She liked three or four songs.
Yeah, it was like kind of her soundtrack.
She, that we know, Super we Tramp. Know, we all, everyone knows she's married to Michael Penn, right?
She's into boxing. She came on the morning show once.
Yeah, she loves me. I love her. This is, we're an unlikely couple.
We need to have her back.
But well, we definitely can. I'll get her on the phone. Yeah, she likes boxing. I like teaching people how to box.
I'm a boxing fan.
Well, that. You, me, and Amy Mann will hang out.
I love you, man.
Let me tell you about Castrol. Castrol Edge. Designed for consumers to demand the best performance for their cars. Castrol Edge. Tech advances made engines smaller, more powerful, more efficient, but they got to work harder, and that's why we need Castrol Edge. The only thing stopping metal-to-metal contacts is a thin layer of oil, so you need that oil to be strong and stay strong. Castrol Edge. Formulated with fluid titanium technology, three times stronger against viscosity breakdown than leading full synthetics, not mixed or blended, but full synthetics. All right, Chuck Negron, everybody. Yeah. Three Dog Night. The Chuck Negron store, it's available. It's got a lot of new chapters, 11 new chapters, 100 new photos.
More smack talk.
More smack talk. but don't worry, everyone's deceased. Originally from 99 and now new with all the new material. And you can just get it on Amazon, bookmark us, and click on through. Chuck, this has been it's nice. Come back anytime you like.
This is great. Thank you so much.
So we will take a quick break, hear some good sports, and we'll love do you, some March Gradness right after this. Hey, it's Adam Carolla. You may know him from putting his body on the line in Jackass, but now Johnny Knoxville is bringing you the wildest stories from the bravest folks he knows on his newest podcast, Pretty Sure I Can Fly. With his co-host, Elna Baker, they have incredible firsthand accounts from folks who surfed 100-foot waves, ride 600 miles per hour in a rocket sled, and wrestle crocodiles just for fun. They've been talking with brave souls who throw caution to the wind and push the boundaries of what humans are capable of. Or, as Johnny would say, they're talking to people who have more balls than a bowling alley. I'm Pretty Sure I Can Fly. Johnny and Elna bring you personal stories from unsung heroes that are part comedy, part adrenaline, and all heart. These are the inspirational, hold my beer stories that will make you want to grab the bull by the horns, literally and figuratively. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcast. You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly right now, early and free, right now on Wondery Plus.
Good sports. It's time for a sports segment. Good sports. It's time for Ace and Dave. Good sports. It's time to get it started.
NFL highlights.
Mixed martial arts fights. Riffing on bats to the
Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. Welcome to the Friday episode of Good Sports presented by Podcast One Sports. Dave Damashek here. Adam Carolla over there. It's, like I say, Friday. It's one of the great, or maybe for a lot of people, I think, the greatest couple of days on the sports calendar. it is fun to sit around and watch these impossible Cinderellas play the juggernaut teams in college basketball. Is it your favorite day? Let me guess. Ace's favorite sports weekend, let's put it that way instead of just one day, sports weekend is the, it's definitely NFL, obviously, but yours is the divisional round. No, you like wild, you like upsets and Cinderella stories, so you like the wild card round of the NFL playoffs.
Yeah, that's good. That's good for me. The weather's cool. You have basically sort of culturally, or not culturally, but sort of, and not legally, but non-judgmental drinking at the, you know, 1 p.m. Nobody judges. You know, I like days, you know, you can't do that on a Wednesday at 1, but that's, you can do it during the playoffs.
And you love that window too. Maybe it is opening day, the first Sunday of NFL season for you, because it starts a 20-week odyssey of booze and secondarily football.
Of eating what you want and seeing all the fellas. I was doing a radio show out of Phoenix last week called Mac and Gatos. And I don't know why, but you've summoned this in me. They were explaining that Barbie is going to come out with some for Women Empowerment Month or whatever it is. They're having a new line of Barbies where they're going to have like Wonder Woman Barbie and Golda Meir Barbie or like whatever historical Amelia Earhart Barbie and this, that, and the other.
Golda Meir one.
They said to me, what Barbie would you like to offer? And I didn't let him finish the sentence, you know, what powerful woman, whatever. And I just said, Marge Schott. I think women, well, let's give the devil her due here. Sure. She owned a major league franchise. I don't know. You tell me how many women have run a major league franchise, especially one with that kind of rich history.
It was allowed for an unusually long period of time to do it around bad decision making and grotesque statements about races of people and everything else. And yet she was able to survive just like an old white man could.
Well, listen, you can aspire all you want to be Wonder Woman, but good luck to you there, sis. I say aspire to own a major league franchise.
Burning a nail, walking her dog around with the big leaguer. She was something else.
Having her dog Shotzi take a dump and just telling like, hey, find me the black outfielder to pick it up. Do we have a black out? Oh, I outlawed him? I did that? What about center? Even center field? Okay.
Now I'm regretting that. 2020 hindsight.
How the hell did she... Her husband must have died and just left her the team, right?
I don't know the
story.
She's
the owner of the... Oh, wait a minute. That was very anti-feminist of me to say some dude, because we want to topple the patriarchy, right? A dude had to die to give her the Cincinnati Reds, although how could it go any other way? But on the other hand...
I can't imagine her as a titan of industry amassing $1 billion so she could purchase the Red Legs.
How many females have ever owned a major league franchise and or NFL or anything? Georgia Frontieri, like her.
But she
somebody drowned suspiciously and now... She gets a team for 20 minutes. But.
I wonder if any, like Tom Benson's daughter, I forget even how that runs with the Saints at this point.
I can look a little further into it, but on her, at the top of her Wikipedia, it says that she is the second woman to buy an existing team rather than inheriting it.
She needs a doll.
Yeah, and it looks like it was after her husband had died.
So she inherited a lot of coin.
She was wealthy. Her husband was wealthy. When he died, she inherited all of his money, and then she bought the team.
Yeah. Was she wealthy before the husband, or was it all husband's money? I can't hear you, sorry.
I'm sorry. The family, her family, was wealthy as well, but presumably...
she still squeezed the trigger on a major league team.
Yeah, that's different. She didn't just take over the team. Right.
Right. She should be admired and looked up to by every young girl.
Looks like she bought the team the same year her husband died.
I'm telling you, Mattel, if you're listening, yeah, you got Frida Kahlo. What, she the unibrow artist chick?
Frida Kahlo,
get at it, please. Chloe Kim, what? She did a 360 on a half pipe on a snowboard and she's 14? Come on. Let's get Marge Schott up there.
Does it come with the nail betwixt her lips? It's a
well. This is right. You accessorize with Shotzi.
I see.
Shotzi was the Saint Bernard. Then right. You have the pack of Winstons. You can upsell here. You know what I mean? There's
smart.
A lot of stuff.
Smart.
Yeah.
I love it. Let me ask
Amelia
you this, Ace.
Amelia Earhart, please. All she did was crash airplanes.
Complete hard right turn here, but I've been waiting to ask you about this. This is, I guess, 8 years in the making. The Winter Games ended a few weeks ago now. But something that's I had a chance to talk a couple of months ago with one Sidney Crosby, a.k.a. the greatest hockey player on the planet Earth right now. And so I asked him a number of questions, and one of them was, or I informed him that back in 2010 in the Winter Games – in the gold medal game, Canada and the USA went to overtime, sudden death overtime. Now, of course, I'm an American, but I'm a Pittsburgh Penguins loyalist. I asked Crosby and told him that when it went to overtime, I announced to no one in particular, I don't want anyone on Canada to score to win, but I want, of all the guys on the ice, I would most want Sidney Crosby to win the gold medal, the glory and beyond against the US of A. So because I'm a Penguins, I went 87 to, you know, I want his legend to grow. I want his mm-hmm. confidence and clutch moments to grow and so on. I rooted for Crosby. I asked him if that was okay. As it turns out, he signed off on it and said it was cool. Adam Carolla, a.k.a. Captain America, where do you come down?
You know, I think if we're against, let's say the USA and it's come down to sudden death and we're skating against Mexico – or Russia.
That'd be a good game. Or cool metal hockey game. Mexico v.
One of any of the undesirable nations. then you're spitting in the face of Uncle Sam
yeah.
if you do not, in effect, root for the US of A. Canada and the United States, you know, it's a very blurry line. You know what I mean? Like, you can't look at Howie Mandel and have any idea that he's from Canada. You wouldn't know it.
Ah,
it doesn't factor in. It's so blurred that, in fact, when you're rooting for Canada, you're just rooting for the other white meat.
So this gets your stamp of approval.
Me and Marge Schott are simpatico on this decision. Yes.
All right. Well, I feel good about it then, because good. Yes, I've gotten a lot of heat from some of our countrymen that this was disloyal and I should have to move north of the of our northern border into, as Kimmel called it many moons ago, America's hat.
Yeah,
Canada.
True.
Okay, good. So I think we've settled a lot of hash here this week on Good Sports. So let's wrap it up there. We'll kibitz with you next week. Hope you're following along on our March Madness tournament. Carolla tweeted it out. So did I. Adam Carolla Show is how you can track it, too, if you want to follow along with the rest of us. More Good Sports on the way for you next week. In the meantime, thanks so much, sports fans. It's been a thin slice of time.
True Car, I'll give you a tip. How about you inflate those tires, man? It really hurts your car, hurts your tires, hurts the wear, hurts the gas mileage. It's tough on everything. Let's get those tires inflated. Get a little compressor. Put it in your garage. Get those tires. Check them once a month. There you go. There's a car tip for you. Here's another tip you might not know. True Car, it helps people get used cars with a certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars. Enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience. So if you want to go new or you want to go used, you see what other people paid, the exact same car you're going to get, and then you get a great deal. And they're motivated. The True Car dealers are motivated to compete with one another and get you a better price. Enjoy a faster buying experience, and you connect with a True Car certified dealer. So when you're ready to buy new, or you're ready to buy used, you always go with True Car.